all monsters are an extremely useful way of viewing ourselves, and all monsters are created by terrors that are useful to look at, you know, that are both attractive and horrifying.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Garrick Jones, and I'm one of the co-authors of the book The Curious Advantage, and I'm delighted to be joined today by John Harris Dunning. Hello, John.
Hello, I'm so pleased to be on.
You are a graphic author of graphic novels and books, including Tumult and Salem Brownstone, and the latest series, Summer Shadows, for Dark Horse Comics. And can you tell me a little bit about your journey? You know, I'm really interested and curious about having a conversation with you about graphic, visual, why comics are important, why they are different from the books that we read, and yet they have a power all of their own. And I also want to talk to you about some of the exhibitions that you've curated, of course. But how did you get here? Tell us a little bit about your journey.
I'm just trying to think about comics in particular. I mean, it's interesting that it's hard even to know terminology to discuss them with. Like, I call them comics or comic books. And for me, that also includes things like, you know, graphic novels like Palestine or Persepolis or Mouse, you know, these more seriously critically acclaimed graphic novels and comics, but they're all comic books to me. You know, it's funny. I think sometimes when people talk to you from other disciplines, they're worried that they're going to insult you, you know, calling you a nasty whore if they mention comic books. But, you know, I don't mind being called that. So comics are comics to me. And then, you know, the fact that they could be classified as literature or art, I mean, they all are to me. So that's terminology. How did I get involved in comic books? I grew up in South Africa during apartheid, and there was a massive control and ban of information, really. So, you know, it was a state of emergency. There was no media coming through. But the one thing that did seem to always get through was comic books. And for me, as a child, they were an absolutely essential kind of source of completely free thinking.
Are you saying that comic books weren't banned under apartheid?
Absolutely.
Or they slipped through?
They slipped through. That's exactly right. So there's a very famous comic book.
That's amazing.
Which was called Crisis. And it was an offshoot of 2000 AD, which is, you know, this sort of famous British comic, which had Judge Dredd and that kind of thing. But Crisis was kind of very, very post Alan Moore, very adult. You know, it was all about the troubles in Northern Ireland. It was all explicitly about South Africa, explicitly about apartheid, explicitly about the Mau Mau in Kenya, all of that kind of thing. Absolutely amazing comic if you haven't seen it. It's hugely underrated. A lot of very important writers and artists like Garth Ennis, who does The Boys, you know, on Netflix. He started off there. I think he was writing there when he was 19 or 20.
Yes.
You know, Steve Dillon, who drew The Preacher and many, many other things as well. He also started there as a very young man, almost as a teenager. Sean Phillips, who's one of my favorite artists ongoing. He's got a series that's been running called Criminal, which is just about to become a big TV show. He also started there. So it was a real kind of hotbed of talent. But that was really anti-apartheid, really, you know, very outspoken. And it would be stocked in CNA every week, the sort of news agent in South Africa. It was hilarious because, I mean, you couldn't get much tamer material, but, you know, it was comics. So they were just like, how bad can it be? So they just never bothered to check any of them. So that was brilliant. So that was the kind of more highbrow explanation. But, you know, maybe the more basic was just, you know, as a kid, I remember it took me quite a long time to read voraciously, which I now do. But I loved comic books from as early as I can remember. And I would read them obsessively. And I remember when I was about 10 years old, I started dreaming in comic book panels with captions and bubbles and balloons and stuff. So I was just really, really obsessed with comics. So it was just sort of a natural true love, I guess.
Astonishing. Can you tell us about your latest series, The Summer Shadows, that you've just published?
I would love to. I'd love to. So it's my first, what they call floppy, which I love that term, which is like basically a sort of single comic book. It's sort of what we all understand, sort of traditional comic book from our childhoods, I guess. And it's a monthly. And it's coming out from Dark Horse, which is a big publisher in the US. They've done some amazing stuff. They did the Hellboy franchise. They did Umbrella Academy on Netflix. They've got amazing, amazing work. So I'm very pleased to be there with them. I did another graphic novel with them called Wiper, which was a sort of science fiction set in South Africa, but that was just came out as a single book. This is coming out as a monthly, and it comes out in four parts starting on the 11th of September. And you can pre-order that now, which is very, very helpful for us. It's a little bit like, in film distribution, you know, they basically decide how important a film is by how many people go and see it in the first weekend. So if anybody wants to go and pre-order Summer Shadows, that'd be great.
Yes.
But it's quite an interesting sort of genre-defying piece, I hope, that it's interesting at least. I know it's genre-defying. And it's a little bit, I think, equal parts Talented Mr. Ripley and Interview with a Vampire. So it's what I'm calling a supernatural psychological thriller. You know, it's not the steaks through the heart and garlic vibes, but, you know, it's maybe a little bit more Anne Rice, exploring this idea, particularly of our modern obsession with youth and staying young and, you know, eternal beauty. And I think also as a gay man, it's something that I experience as well, you know, sort of in my space as a gay man in society, I guess, like, you know, there's something about gay culture, which really does, you know, obsess about youth and youthfulness, maybe a little bit more than straight culture. Although right now I think it's kind of universal obsession. It's all set in Greece, and I spend a little bit of every year in Greece over summer. I spend a couple of months here, and I absolutely adore it. You know, so it was inspired by that and the kind of beauty of it and the history as well, which is just so deep and so profound and all pervasive.
I have a bookshelf in my library, which is just graphic novels. Some of the people you mentioned, like Alan Moore and Sean Phillips and Persepolis, and some of those Mouse, for example, some of those great things. There's something about them that is compelling. It's, you know, we all, well, I certainly grew up reading Asterix and Obelix, and I got a lot of my introduction to history from there.
Yeah.
Probably Tintin was another one that was massively influential. And then there were all the DC comics, of course, you know, the DC Universe and Superman and Marvel, and all of those have become box sets and series now and living in a different world. But it's the comics originally, you know, you find a comic. And even in the UK, I don't know if you remember Giles.
Yeah.
Giles is an incredible, used to be published a weekly, and a single panel which had Granny and all the other families in Giles, social commentary. All you wanted to say about what was going on in society at the time in one panel.
Yeah.
And so richly captured. What is it about the visual and the graphic that is so compelling and that is somehow different and engaging from just reading text?
Great question. I mean, I wish I could answer it comprehensively, but I've got a couple of ideas that might be useful for you and listeners to think about, like they have been for me. I mean, one is there is an absolutely, if someone's really serious about this area, there's a fantastic book by a guy called Scott McCloud called Understanding Comics. And it's sort of the great text of comics criticism, but it's very approachable. I mean, it's done as a comic. And so it's beautifully done. But one of the things he talks about is how language originates as image imbued with meaning. And all the early alphabets, you know, Akkadian, Egyptian hieroglyphics, all of those things started as image related to text. And in fact, it got further and further and further separated all the way through, even into sort of ancient Greek and Roman. There was a relationship between the letters and writing and the image that became more and more divorced until
the
Victorian period, where there was just reams of text. And then it started to collapse again, you know, with the 20th century, really. It started to become, image started to fight with word, and those two things started to recombine. So I think there's something absolutely intrinsic to language. It's almost like comics is a pure alphabet. It's closer to the original alphabet and to what we need from an alphabet than our alphabets are. I really believe that.
Yeah.
On a more kind of personal note, that I see, as I always find it so interesting that there's such a great gateway drug to reading and to a love of books as well. So, you know, I notice with kids, you know, whenever people say to me their children are struggling with reading, or, you know, they're very dyslexic, or, you know, they have various issues, you give a kid a comic book and they will sit there and read for 8 hours until that book is finished, you know. So there's something really beautiful about the immediacy of that. You know, I'm a writer. I don't draw. You know, I love drawing and stuff, but I don't draw for my comics. I love working with other artists. It's one of my, I think it's one of the most exciting things.
You work with an artist?
Yeah, I work with different artists, actually. Ricardo Cabral is the artist I'm working on Summer Shadows with, and he did my book, Wiper. I mean, we're great collaborators. We'll do other things together. So he's absolutely fantastic. You know, I work with Mike Kennedy for Tumult. You know, he's now doing stuff for McSweeney's and The New Yorker. He's done very, very well. And he's got his own book coming out as well from Drawn and Quarterly in September. He's fantastic at talent as well. So it's really, really good working with different artists. There's something about, I can go anywhere in the world, and even if somebody doesn't speak the same language as me, you know, I can show them my comic and they will immediately get exactly what story I'm telling and the mood and the atmosphere and sort of what I do. It's quite interesting. So there's something very universal about comics, and you find that because, you know, most places have them. I mean, when you really dig down into it, you will find comics as a language almost everywhere. Just thinking about South Africa, one of the things that I haven't done enough research on, but I've seen bits and pieces of, is that there was a big tradition of photo comics in South Africa. So there was one that was called Die Swart Leibat, which, you know, I knew as a kid, which was a sort of very, like a very dodgy white guy dressed up in a sort of tight black outfit with a very bad black leopard mask, sort of prancing around fighting crime. But actually what I've seen, which is more interesting, is I think in Johannesburg earlier, like in the 50s and 60s, in what became Triumph, which was a Sophia town, which was razed to the ground by the apartheid government because there was such an incredible creative flowering happening, mostly black, but it was also quite interracial. It was sort of everything that the South African government didn't want happening. There were kind of photo comics, which were sort of gangster comics. Everybody in fedoras and suits in the 50s and 60s, very glamorous, with kind of, you know, photo comics with kind of word balloons over them and stuff, which are absolutely amazing documents at the time. So comics are very rich kind of cultural source and quite universal, actually.
And they have a history of subversion, I imagine. I'm thinking of Mexico when you talk, and there was when Mexico was subjected to quite a lot of military control and also the church. There was a lot of subversion that came out in comics and sort of fanzines that emerged sort of in the ghettos and so on. I really want to talk to you about your acclaimed exhibition, Comics Unmasked, Art and Anarchy in the UK, which was at the British Library and which drew on all the resources and the comics in the archive there. Can you tell us a little bit about the concept of the exhibition and how it was organised and what you showed?
It was kind of a dream come true, and it was one of those strange projects that just went so well, and it was just so easy, the entire thing. It was kind of extraordinary. So I had heard years ago that the back catalogue, you know, the original artwork and stuff at 2000 AD, which had changed ownership, had basically just been thrown out into the garbage one day in the rain, and that was the end of that. So, you know, the whole archive was gone. And at the same time, I'd been going to Angoulême, which is the big comic book convention and festival in France, which is the best comics festival in the world, to my mind, and just seeing how seriously the French take it, and then seeing the whole European approach to comics and their love for comics, and, you know, their comics curators and comics archivists and big government sponsorship to look after the comics tradition of those countries. And, you know, in the UK, there's just absolutely no support for that at all. And the comics material was being destroyed. And at the very best, it was being exported to the US, you know, where it was being collected by people. So I felt like quite strongly we had to put a stake in the ground. We had to create some sort of responsibility for the comics tradition in the UK, which is profoundly important, particularly in American comics. But, you know, we have our own tradition as well.
It's huge. I mean, I think about the UK and Beano, for example. All the children comics in the UK are amazing and hugely influential in the sort of education of my generation. I don't know anymore.
And, you know, and then you had this thing, the British invasion, where Alan Moore went over to America and wrote Watchmen and took over American comics. Neil Gaiman went over and wrote Sandman, took over American comics. You know, Grant Morrison, who's, you know, just one of my absolute favorites, he went over and wrote Doom Patrol, and eventually like an absolutely key Batman. I mean, he also completely took over American and therefore global comics. So there's a huge tradition there. So I was determined to do this. So I wrote a letter 3 times a year to the British Library for 5 years, none of which were answered. And then finally, this guy was leaving and he was asked what he would like his last exhibition to be. And he said he would like it to be comics. So I was brought in finally. I mean, the British Library were just the most incredible people to work with in the entire world. They just so got behind it. They loved it. But it was very interesting because after the Second World War, a lot of their material was not properly categorized, as you can imagine, because, you know, they were being bombed and there was sort of, you know, there was no staff. But they did collect a lot of the stuff. So there was a huge amount of comics there that hadn't been properly catalogued. And that's one of the things that the exhibition did, was kind of get the stuff catalogued and available for the public, which it now is. So, you know, they've got a really, really great collection there. And what I did was brought my dear friend, Paul Gravett, who's a writer about comics and many other things. He's basically just a fixture in comics globally. Great researcher and discoverer of new comics and traditions. I brought him on board, and together with Adrian Edwards, who was an internal curator, we basically just went crazy and did this show, which was, when it opened, it was the most successful show they'd had at the British Library. And it was certainly the show that had brought in, I mean, people, I think it was, I mean, a giant proportion of the audience had never been to the British Library before. So it was just so good for everybody, you know, brought people who'd never been to the British Library in. Then it also really allowed people who hadn't really approached comics before to maybe approach them differently with a different attitude because it's at the British Library. So it was huge fun. And what we decided to do was approach it as what is the seditious tradition in comics. And we found that very powerful. I mean, because we saw that that was absolutely the case. You know, comics have always flown under the radar, and people who do comics have been allowed access to young minds in a way that is not properly policed, and to the minds of the population generally. So, you know, political views, views about gender, sex, sexuality, the occult, religion, you know, all of these things have been discussed in a way that haven't really been discussed in that same way in other places, and certainly not in mass media, you know, just because they're too policed, you know. And I think it's quite interesting because, you know, one of my absolute favorite comic book creators of all time, a guy called Daniel Klaus, he was worried. I interviewed him many years ago for Dazed and Confused, and he was worried about the respectability that comics were achieving, because, you know, he was saying, we've always been the kind of in the gutter, and we've always been outside of people's policing. So I'm worried that now that we're becoming accepted into the mainstream and sort of literary and art spaces, that maybe that was
mainstream. He doesn't want them to be mainstream.
Yeah, I quite like that. I mean, it's so punk rock, you know. I mean, of course, you know, as soon as you become successful, you complain bitterly about it. But it did stick with me that there was something. I mean, you know, the material that we saw in the British Library was just, it's so wild and untrammeled. You know, you really want that to be preserved.
We're talking to John Harris Dunning, who's the writer of graphic novels, including Salem Brownstone, Tumult, and the latest series, Summer Shadows, from Dark Horse Comics. John has also curated the acclaimed Comics Unmasked, Art and Anarchy in the UK exhibition at the British Library, the most prestigious exhibition of comics to be held in Britain ever, which used the comic resources and archives of the British Library. John is also a social commentator who writes for GQ, Esquire, Dazed, ID, and The Guardian, etc. John, you're amazing. I have to talk to you about curiosity, though. How do you define curiosity, and what are you curious about?
I think it's absolutely all important. I love the fact that that's what drives this podcast. Do you know, we sometimes look at somebody on social media. I mean, you know, to be honest, it is maybe something which is like a young person's thing to say. But when they say they're bored, I cannot understand people when they say they're bored. You know, I mean, adults say it as well. Like, what are you up to? I'm bored. It's just, I don't get it. So for me, curiosity is the lifeblood of existence, really. You know, I always find, and this is where, you know, my process of comics is, I'm always researching something which I'm proposing to do. I mean, I'd probably do 2% of the project that I'm thinking about, but curiosity drives everything I read and everything I do.
Do you have a view on AI and, you know, the generation of images through AI? Do you have a view on how that may impact our world in some way, or your world,
yeah,
the comic world, for example?
It fills me with horror, really, at this point. And I think it fills a lot of people in comics with horror because of what is happening with it. So there's this thing called scraping, where they basically, artist material will be fed into AI and be able to reproduce somebody's material, which is being used, at, you know, and then it creates all sorts of issues with creators, you know, and sort of stealing off somebody's material, you know, all this kind of thing. So it's not a thing of beauty. I also, and this is my ignorance, because I find AI kind of something which is not useful to me at this point. I don't know enough about it, but I look at a lot of AI material. It just looks so cheesy, you know, like, it's a photography stuff, you know, exactly the kind. It's like you can just see the search terms in these really bad, like, kind of computers sort of generated images. So they're not lovely and they're not massively exciting to me. And I think that there is a danger that if extremely kind of commercial, gauche, capitalistic forces wanted to use these tools to produce very low quality material at no cost, it's becoming possible.
Yeah.
I think that's the danger. But I've got such belief in people's innate curiosity and delight in the unusual and creative that I hope that what it is a bit like a panic about digital music and the creation of kind of instruments through technology. You know, I hope that's the case, but I'm not massively excited about this point. Having said that, there's an artist called Dave McKean who collaborated with Neil Gaiman and did all the Sandman covers. He's an amazing painter. He did Arkham Asylum famously with Grant Morrison, which was the most successful graphic novel of all time when it was released. And, you know, he's an artist's artist. He's been quite playful with AI and he's been quite curious about it and not treating it with, you know, like Frankenstein's monster. And he's still questioning it. I mean, I don't think he's embracing it with open arms, but, you know, let's see. You know, for me, it's not a great tool because it's a bit like you look at a paperback from the 80s, which I have an obsession with and collect obsessively, and you look at a Kindle. I mean, the Kindle is the lesser form of technology for me. I mean, it might be more complicated, but it just doesn't work as well as a lovely, chunky 80s paperback with a sleazy, lurid cover. Yeah. And I feel the same with AI art. Like, you know, it's interesting to see a performing monkey like AI art, but, you know, I mean, there are so many great comic artists who just do a better job. So I just don't know why you'd be using it. But who knows? Who knows where it goes?
Maybe it's going to be like all things. We play with it now, we figure it out, we incorporate where it's useful, and then it has a life of its own. But the thing about humans is we tend to adapt and evolve and keep on finding ways to keep ourselves relevant, perhaps. I'm not afraid of humans being wiped out by AI, nor comic books being wiped out by AI, because there's something very beautiful about holding something that has been created by a human. And, you know, when you know it's drawn by a human, you feel that. I think you do.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing to bear in mind about, you know, artificial intelligence is, you know, it's a misnomer. It's not intelligence. You know, it's to do with algorithms.
Yeah.
It's a mimetic thing. You know, it's miming. It's producing things which are being reprocessed off things which already exist. So it's not an intelligence necessarily. It's a way of recreating or reproducing in reformatted ways. And I think that language is quite problematic because I think that language makes people afraid of what it is, you know, like, oh my God, it's going to start thinking for us. But it can't think. It doesn't think. It produces things that we request of it. And it's just about how, as you say, how we use it and how we adapt it to our purposes. I mean, I think one of the terrors, it's maybe a useful terror, is it's highlighting our terror of living in a completely capitalist society where if it really is all about saving money and making money, then the cheaper and the easier something is, even if all art of any quality disappears, is useful because it's that saves cash and it makes money. So then that must be good. So I think it's highlighting these things which you know, we have to deal with anyway.
Oh, this is fascinating. So that what you're saying is that it highlights our own humanity in some way, and it causes a reflection on what are the values that in society and what do we really value and what do we want to value going forward.
Let me bring this back to a really good marketing ploy here. Speaking of Summer Shadows, my new series, which starts on the 11th of September, which is about vampires and not about vampires.
Yes, please do.
But still talking about AI and what we've just been discussing, all monsters are an extremely useful way of viewing ourselves. And all monsters are created by terrors that are useful to look at, you know, that are both attractive and horrifying. Just looking at vampires, you know, I'm looking at Dracula being this kind of, it's Victorian period where women are covering their table legs because, you know, they're so afraid of sex. And they want to be ravished by this thousand-year-old, handsome, bestial, blood-sucking monster, you know, which is obviously like super attractive and titillating. Then you get, you know, the AIDS crisis and you get this terror of sex happening in America in the 80s and the complete annihilation of this incredible work that had been done by gay men and women, you know, in terms of sex in the 60s and 70s, and this liberation that was happening in America, completely annihilated by the AIDS crisis. And then you get Anne Rice's gay, erotic vampires, you know, with her Vampire Chronicles and Interview with a Vampire. So these monsters come to save us, basically, because they keep this conversation going.
I'm so curious about monsters. Tell me more about monsters and the role that monsters play.
I never thought that this would be this conversation. I love the fact you're saying, I'm so curious about monsters. Well, as I say, you know, those are the vampires that I'm looking at. So for instance, the vampires that, you know, I'm looking at now are maybe about this idea of gay men being afraid of aging and also maybe placing youth and beauty above all other things. Although, you know, I think that that's, as I say, quite universal across all different people in the world. But then it's also maybe playing a little bit with, I don't know if you've heard of Brian Johnson, this entrepreneur who's trying to stay youthful as well and is basically using the blood of his son, which he's, you know, basically drawing out of his son and rinsing through his body. I mean, you know, these sort of very exaggerated, you know, these kind of like biohacks. That's what I'm playing with in my book. I'm sure there's very nice billionaires. I don't know a lot of billionaires, so I can't judge really. But, you know, there's also just something about Summer Shadows started, was inspired by this idea that, you know, I'm on this little Greek island. It's absolutely perfect beach. There's almost nobody there. It's very wild and very raw. And then suddenly around the corner of this cove comes this giant black yacht that just sits there for 3 days. You don't see anybody coming in and out. And then it disappeared. And that just started me thinking about, like, who's on this yacht? What is this money buying you? Like, if you're sitting in this kind of giant plastic.
It's the monster.
It's the monster, you know. And the monster is this kind of, this mad money-making, which we're all told we need to do. You know, we need to make money. And if you're rich, you're successful, you know, all this kind of thing. But it sort of, it eventually becomes a coffin, you know, not wanting to be too obvious a metaphor. And then you're in this coffin floating around. And that was my useful use of monsters. And that comes back to what you're saying, you know, it's like, what are monsters? Monsters are really important voices of our cultural conscience, really, in a way. They always are. There's always a reason for a monster. These monsters don't happen for nothing. And it's just so interesting how they come about culturally. You know, I know that you spent time in Greece as well. And vampires are massive in Greece. The most recent time when there was huge panic about vampires was in the 50s in Greece. After the Second World War, there was a terrible famine and people were dying and there was huge social instability. And, you know, and there was a massive belief in vampires and terror about vampires. So it's just really interesting.
In many cultures. In Greece, for example, they have, I think the term is the Kalakaisarai. African cultures too, the monster is always there. You know, Western culture, the Beauty and the Beast, you know, there's always the monster.
Yeah.
The extreme and exaggerated version of ourselves, perhaps, or the thing we're most afraid of, the other, the scary monster. Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman.
That's right. And of course, as we all know, the other is always oneself. That's what one's really afraid of. You know, I mean, I'm thinking of Frankenstein here, and it's such an incredible work. But I mean, what it is this moment where you're starting to see real, you know, strides forward in medicine, in science, and, you know, suddenly man has feels that he's starting to have a certain responsibility in nature, and then realizing that we just have no idea what to do with it. And actually, we are very savage ourselves. And it's probably not a good idea for us to have very much power, you know, certainly not over life or death. You know, as we saw, you know, since, you know, what, 100 years later, we were dropping nuclear bombs on each other. You know, she was definitely right, Mary Shelley. But it's interesting that she, you know, that monster Frankenstein was very much her looking at her society and seeing what could go wrong. She was looking at her time and her people, really, and creating this Frankenstein's monster out of it.
I'm really enjoying our conversation. I have to say, I hadn't expected us to talk about monsters. And certainly, it's been fascinating talking about the visual and the power of comics and the role they have in society to keep things open and subterfuge in some way, the way that they kind of cause us to look at what we take for granted and exist to kind of keep us thinking and being critical in many respects. I'm wondering, as we come to the end of this, what are you personally most curious about now, John?
I think I hadn't really thought of it, Gary, but I think I'm most curious about format right now, because I think that's the challenge all of us are being given across all of the arts, you know, the visual arts generally, cinema, literature, comic books. The formats are changing so quickly, and the way audiences are interacting with them so quickly, that's what I'm curious about, because I have such a belief in the things I'm passionate about because they're so human and they're so ancient. But I'm also aware that one has to be really nimble about how one's presenting them and how one's interacting with them. That's what I'm curious about. And I think it's probably to do with the confidence in one's passion and then an ability to really kind of roll with the punches and be super organic. And actually, that's quite exciting. I mean, the last thing I want is everything to stay the same. So one has to believe that change can be good.
That's amazing. I have a question for you about if people are wanting to get into graphic novels or wanting to get into comics and they haven't really explored it much, but they're curious and they want to read a few, do you have a couple of titles and authors who you've mentioned that you would suggest as a great starting point or a way forward?
Definitely.
Other than yours, of course.
All of mine, obviously. for me, a really, really good universal place to start would be to get Daniel Clowes, which is C-L-O-W-E-S, Ghost World, as a grown-up book. You know, that's something that a teenager would love, but as an adult, you know, it's a serious piece of literature. And I think what's so impressive about him is that he draws as well as writes it. So he's a kind of great writer and he's a great artist. So that's kind of amazing. You know, if you're feeling that you're not into comics, but, you know, you're into politics, then maybe it's something like Mouse, you know, which is in all the bookshops and is absolutely fabulous. And that, I think, is a great one to convert people who you don't think they're into comics, you know, into comics. There's another one, which is Incal, which is I-N-C-A-L, which is just so astonishingly comicsy. It's science fiction. You know, people would argue that a lot of Star Wars was based on it. You know, it was very inspired by Dune, the books, obviously. And it's really its own absolutely mad science fiction on a level of mastery you just can't believe. The artist, Mobius, is one of the great comic book artists of all time. And then Hodorowski obviously is a great filmmaker, and he wrote it, and he wrote a whole series of comics on it. So that's it. But I mean, you know, if you want to get sleazy, you know, and you're just like unabashed, you're like, I'm going to get sleazy and I'm going to just read some comics. One of my absolute favorites is She-Hulk. There's a little volume of She-Hulk by a guy called Charles Soule, S-O-U-L-E, with an artist called Javier Pulido. And it is the most joyous comics you've ever seen. It's just proper pow, bam, whap, beautiful pop art, really funny, really moving and incredible. And my last volume would be, there's a volume series called Hawkeye, and it's by an artist called David Aja, A-J-A. And that's absolutely incredible as well. It's sort of Marvel superheroes, but it is unbelievably clever. I mean, one issue is just from the perspective of his dog, and the whole thing is done with little images of what he smells and what that means in his brain. and then the architecture of the building they live in. So there's these kind, it almost looks like a sort of architectural layout with these scents that you follow through to see what this dog is thinking. It's absolutely incredible. But, you know, that's just my mad little list, really. I think the best thing you could do is, my comic book shop that I use, because I'm in London, is called Gosh. And I go there often, even, you know, with my knowledge and the stuff that I know about comics, because I'm obsessive, and I will still ask them and they'll still give me something which I don't know anything about. So I really, really recommend that. Just go to, you know, your local comic book shop, yabber away to the person at the counter. They'll always be delighted to suggest stuff to you. And that's always a great way in.
Community is a way in.
Yeah.
If there's one thing to leave us with, and to leave all of our listeners with, John, what would it be?
Read more comics. Seriously, I mean that. Like, you know, as I say, even I go through phases where I'm like, oh, I'm feeling a bit, you know, burnt out on comics, whatever. And then I go back in and there's just another whole universe of material, you know, whether it's Japanese, whether it's European, whether it's South American, whether it's, you know, Filipino. I mean, there are comics everywhere of the most incredible traditions. There is so much material. I also think they're so good for us in this modern age, because I think we struggle with concentration, not just because of, you know, of smartphones and stuff. I just mean in terms of our lifestyles. We're running around. We work hard. It's busy. You're traveling. There's something about comics which is very focusing and very calming, because it's not moving image. So it's image and it's words, but it's still, and it's not passive. You know, you are actively unraveling it, and it's very relaxing. So, you know, for comics lovers, buy more comics. But, you know, for people who don't think they love comics, go and try some and just see what you think. Because, you know, I've never had a bad experience. I've turned so many people onto them. And then they're a delight, even as a grown-up, especially as a grown-up.
Read more comics. Thank you so much for joining us, John. That has been a fascinating conversation.
For me as well.
I really appreciate it. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to light the latest understandings from neuroscience, anthropology, history, art, business, behaviorism about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. You've been listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what have you learned. We've also always appreciated hearing your thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today, hashtag Curious Advantage. The Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide from great bookshops. Order your physical, digital, or audio copy book now to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. Subscribe to the podcast today and follow The Curious Advantage on LinkedIn and Instagram and other major channels. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.